You're in the studio with Redbeard. Today in the studio, it's a special edition. Did my love open the door
to your heart? Empty Glass, I was groping for a title for the album, which would demonstrate that what I believed at the time was that I was there really with an empty heart. I felt that I was ready to undertake a journey, but that I wasn't particularly equipped. All that I knew was that my heart was like an empty glass waiting to be filled with something. Being a very heavy drinker at the time, it was a kind of a mischievous way to also bring in my difficulties with alcohol at the time. My glass was always empty, because if I filled it, I drank it immediately. Hi, I'm Pete Townsend, in the studio for the best of my solo work.
If you had the opportunity to see The Who as recently as fall 2001, ripping powerfully and nimbly through their four decades of hits, it could be easy to forget that Pete Townsend, The Who's iconic guitar player and practically soul songwriter, had a substantial solo career. Starting as far back as 1972, Townsend wrote and released his songs outside of the incredibly successful artistic vehicle that was The Who. So I asked Pete in the studio what first led him to do so.
I think it was a number of different things. I think essentially what had actually happened to me anyway was that I'd realized that I'd developed a completely personal way of dealing with my creative life. Although I'd grown up in a band, what I was actually doing as an artist, as a songwriter, and almost also to some extent as a stage performer, was performing in isolation and alone, as it were, in a bubble. Even sometimes feeling that way on stage with The Who, I didn't feel particularly like part of a band. I felt that I was an individual in a band, and I think that was one of the interesting things about The Who, is that they were four individuals who happened to work well together as a band. Anyway, I think today, looking back, I'm even more certain that was a correct view of what was going on for me at the time. We're talking about the late 70s when I started to pursue a solo career in earnest, around 78, 79, that kind of time. It was just after The Who had finished the Who Are You album. We were drifting into movies. We'd produced a movie of Quadrophenia. We'd produced a movie of our own life called The Kids Are All Right. We'd been involved in the production of several other films, including the McVicar film, in which Roger played a leading role. But we were getting involved in all kinds of things outside of The Who's immediate purpose, which was to make records and tour.
I've always loved Pete Townsend's choir boy voice and uplifting spirit in the song Pure and Easy from his first solo effort, Who Came First, in 1972. The song was written originally for Townsend's ambitious Lifehouse rock opera, which he wrote for The Who as the follow-up to the brilliant Tommy. But Lifehouse was aborted as unworkable. I asked Pete Townsend where the song Pure and Easy would have appeared in the original Lifehouse storyline.
It was quite early in the piece. It was something that established the whole notion that the hero of the story had, that life is a spiritual journey which can be explained in a poetic sense by using the analogy the analogy of music, that each of us has a function, each of us has a place in life, however low or high we feel about it. We're all very important. And I just used the analogy that we all come from one note and we all go back to that one note, in as much as we, you know, scientifically speaking, we all come from one particle and we will all end up going back to it sooner or later. later, I hope.
Townsend, who played all of the instruments on Pure and Easy, has a certain simplicity to his drumming, which I find very appealing, and not unlike the drumming on early solo albums by Paul McCartney, John Fogerty, Stevie Wonder, and Todd Rundgren. I wondered aloud to Pete Townsend what that similarity implied.
Well, I think because we, as writers playing on our own work, we're interested only in serving the song. So I think that it's the syndrome of the composer being the king. You know, I can do a fairly good Keith Moon impersonation, but I tended not to do it. I mean, obviously, I'm nothing like the drummer that he is, or in fact, the drummer that anybody is. I'm not a good drummer particularly, but I what I would always be interested in doing was serving the song. And today, in this world of drum machines and stuff like that, I find myself always leaning towards the most fundamental part that will actually support the song itself, rather than make any great display of my ability to program drums. I wasn't really interested in... I was very keen... You know, you mentioned close miking. I mean, partly that was because I had such a tiny room to work in, but partly also that was the fashion of the times. If you go back and listen to the album called Big Pink that the band made at the time, I mean, that was the seminal band-produced record. You know, they produced, they made that recording, I think, themselves. They were very much in control of it themselves. And the drum sound on that record was very, very tight, close-miked, simply recorded and simply played. And I think that was the sound that a lot of people aspired to. I think it was much, much later, maybe even post-Led Zeppelin, when Bonzo from Led Zeppelin, John Bonham, started to use this massive, echoey, long-distance mic drum sound that sounded like, you know, cannons across a battlefield, that we moved to this larger ambient sound. Prior to that, that was the fashion of the day. So it was a small sound, but one that was, that, as you say, was very controlled. But the main thing was to make it fit the song, you know. I think I remember on Paul McCartney's first album that it was all done at home, and what I loved about that was his drumming. It was really good drumming. I feel it's a step towards an intimacy with that particular kind of fan that wants that from me, and the feedback that I get from people that have lived with those records is of a slightly different order than the feedback that I get from people that have mainly seen The Who in concert or heard Who records on the radio. It's not to say that it's better, but it certainly is, as you say, much more intimate.
I'm sitting in the Sheraton Gibson, playing my Gibson. And boy, do I wanna go home. I'm sitting in the Sheraton Gibson, playing my Gibson. And boy, do I feel all alone.
Lighthearted road song Sheraton Gibson comes from Pete Townsend's 1972 solo debut Who Came First, whose very album title and cryptic cover photo alluded to several issues. First, there was Townsend in a white jumpsuit and high-topped laced black industrial boots, later to become a punk rock and then again a grunge fashion footwear statement with Doc Martens. There was Townsend walking on eggshells on the cover. Now, you don't have to be Sigmund Freud to grasp the symbolism, right? And then there's the title itself. Is Who Came First a question or a declaration from Pete Townsend?
When I did Who Came First, I was still deeply, deeply, deeply committed exclusively to The Who as my main outlet for my writing, and I think the album title is meant to express that. As the songs were all gathered on that particular record, on Who Came First, with a spiritual purpose, all of those songs are meant to have some kind of spiritual function, that I should address the fact that the songs came from the place which they were intended to go back to. But that also I wanted to acknowledge that I was a member of this rock band called The Who, and that whatever I did at that time, they would certainly come first. I think I wanted to make it clear that that was not my first solo album. I don't regard that record as my first solo album. I regard Empty Glass as my first solo album, which came much, much later.
My baby wakes in the deep of the night. She doesn't need it, but she says it's all right. My baby digs into some rolling away. My baby gives it up. Yeah.
Pete Townsend with the late Ronnie Lane from a one-off album in 1977, Rough Mix, with the song My Baby Gives It Away. Next, find out what Pete Townsend's solo song was dedicated to both his two young daughters as well as the notorious Sex Pistols. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and visit inthestudio.net for more rock interviews. I'm Redbeard with the legendary Pete Townsend in the studio.
Hi, I'm Pete Townsend, in the studio for the best of my solo work.
And I'm Redbeard. The late 1970s were particularly tumultuous for The Who. First, drummer Keith Moon died in 1978. Then, 11 fans were trampled to death at a Who concert in Cincinnati in 1979. Meanwhile, Pete Townsend was struggling to write for the band.
I suddenly felt very much as though, you know, my inner life, my creative life, the things that I wanted to say were not so much being neglected, but they were becoming narrower. It was less possible, more extreme, it was less possible to incorporate them into the generality that The Who had become. Because I think what actually happened is that we became better known for our more anthemic works like Won't Get Fooled Again and Barbara O'Reilly, rather than for the slightly more impish humour that we'd started our life with. And as I grew older, I realised that I'd kind of lost the ability to express that sense of humour. And strangely enough, when I started to write songs on my own, I think humour was about the last thing that emerged. I think for a long time, the first couple of albums I wrote were full of personal pathos. But that was really where it all came from. I think it was a clear view of myself as an artist and a clear view of my own needs as an artist. It wasn't that I felt The Who wanting in any way. I didn't feel that they didn't provide me with anything. I felt that I wasn't serving them very well, and I thought that perhaps that pursuing a solo career would in fact help me to serve The Who better. In actual fact, what happened was is that I ended up stopping working for The Who at all.
Top boys running the streets, come a little closer, rough toys under the sheets.
Townsend's Rough Boys from his 1980 solo album Empty Glass is where Townsend dedicated the song to the punk purge, but also to his then school-age daughters.
The punk explosion in the UK was just starting to diminish a little bit, but I suppose I was in the studio around 78, so it had been happening for a while. And what it had deteriorated into, the punk movement in the UK, was a kind of fashion exercise. It was young men walking up and down the King's Road with very, very, very spiky Vaseline hair, rings in every nose and, you know, leather gear, dog collars, lots of studs, lots of leather. And it was strange. I found it, you know, like most people, I found it a very tough and really quite intimidating look. But it also reminded me and evoked to me the kind of village people look that I'd seen in New York several years before, which was also lots of dog collars, changed leather and Vaselined hair. And I decided to make the connection. And so the song is about those not so much gender issues that exist between this very sort of tough leather-clad look that came from both, you know, the New York gay scene in the 70s, but also from punk. But the sexual issues, the difficulties that are associated with both sexual prejudice, but also when we decide that because somebody wears a particular outfit that they must be of a particular sexual persuasion, and how wrong we can often be. I suppose it was one of those don't f*** with me songs, you know. It's one of those songs about whatever the look, you know, inside there is somebody that is strong and defiant and is going to stick to their principles whatever happens. My girls would then have been about 8 and 10, and I think what I really loved about them both at the time was is that despite the fact that their daddy was in a rock band, that they were, you know, quite a big rock band, and was obviously going through some kind of sea change personally. I think it was a very strange time of my life then. they were both very much their own people. They were both independent. They had their own ideas about what they were going to do with their life. I think the song is about that. It's about being true to your own feeling about yourself, to who you really think you are.
Also on Pete Townsend's 1980 Empty Glass solo album was the hit Let My Love Open the Door.
I think I was very clear about what I was writing. I think wanted to write a fairly light-hearted song about love in its, I suppose, its most general form. You know, the idea of love as a force which helps people to help each other through identifying with one another. You know, if you attempt to convey a sense of compassion and empathy with another human being, I think that is a beginning of a process of real love and care for other people, and that the song's really about that, I suppose, a spiritual love, a reflection of God's love. But I also felt that you know, that I'd started to get a bit high-flown in my attempts to work in this particular area, and I thought maybe it would be possible to, you know, just write a pop song which on the surface would appear to be a song about a man claiming that he had, you know, a big dick or something, you know, that his ability to make the girls fall in love with him was bigger and better than everybody else's. I think to begin with, that's how the song came over. But I think in due course, the underlying theme of it has landed.
After revealing his Sufi spiritual advisor, Meher Baba, the Maharishi's influence continued to inform Pete Townsend's work on the album Empty Glass.
We were having a conversation once, and I think I was right in the middle of working on this record, on Empty Glass, and I was having a hard time. I really was at the time. I was very, very overstretched. I had financial difficulties. I had all kinds of problems, but the main problem for me at the time was I was experiencing my first real glimpse of marital breakdown, I suppose. Back then, it was difficult. And he said to me, well, you know, how do you feel about all this? And I said, I feel terrible. And he said, well, so she says she doesn't love you. So what did you say? I said, well, I asked her if she loved me at all. And he said, well, what did she say? I said, well, she said she might love me a little bit. And he said, you know, Pete, that should be enough. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, a little should be enough. And I said, how can a little be enough, you know, when you're talking about something as important as love? And he said, well, it's precisely because we're speaking of love. He said, love is infinite. It emanates from, you know, God's most supreme universal manifestation. Everything is motivated by it. Everything is driven by it. A tiny fraction of that complete ocean is as important as the ocean itself. And so, you know, in the case if she loves you a little, then that should be enough. And I kind of carried that off, and it saw me through what was a kind of difficult couple of years. And has actually seen me through a lot of lean times, I think, because, you know, I think it's very easy to forget that we should be grateful simply for being alive. We should be grateful simply for seeing the sun come up. Today, I've got a much better sense of that, philosophically speaking, than I had when I actually wrote the song. So it means a lot to me because I think I've grown into it. And it seems a very wise thing of me to have written when I was actually quite so fractured.
That's Pete Townsend commenting on the philosophy embodied in his song A Little Is Enough from his 1980 solo album Empty Glass. Pete will share the meaning behind that album's title next when we return. follow In the Studio on Facebook, and hear this and many more musician interviews at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Pete Townsend. Hi, and welcome back. I'm Redbeard, in the studio.
Hi, I'm Pete Townsend, in the studio for the best of my solo work.
And I'm Redbeard. The 1978 accidental overdose death of The Who's rascal drummer Keith Moon was a tremendous blow to the three surviving members, particularly Pete Townsend, who, not surprisingly, only increased his consumption of alcohol to numb the pain.
Later, on Empty Glass, I was groping for a title for the album, which would demonstrate that what I believed at the time was that I was there really with an empty heart. I felt that I was ready to undertake a journey, but that I wasn't particularly equipped. All that I knew was that my heart was like an empty glass, waiting to be filled with something. And I grabbed at the idea because Hafiz and Rumi, both well known poets from Persia, both use the analogy of God's love being like wine, and being a very heavy drinker at the time, it was a kind of a mischievous way to also bring in my difficulties with alcohol at the time. My glass was always empty, always, you know, because if I filled it, I drank it immediately. That led directly to, a sense that, you know, as fast as I tried to fill the hole in my soul, I realized that was an impossible job. That was not something that I could do. That hole in my soul had to be filled in some other way. And by the time I got to Chinese Eyes, I think I was actually dealing with that metaphor far more directly.
I was just 34 years old, and I was still wandering in a haze. I was wondering why everyone I met seemed like they were lost in a maze. I don't know why I thought I should have some kind of divine ride to the blues. It's sympathy, not tears, people need when they're the front page says.
Pete Townsend's 1982 solo album All the Best Cowboys Have Chinese Eyes contained the complex yet frank examination of his relationship with his wife called Slit Skirts. 3 years later, Townsend tackled a less personal but equally complicated social theme on his White City solo album.
It's really about empire, about nationality, about neighborhood, about community, ghettoization. All those things about the neighborhood I grew up in was really rather strange, and the White City was at the center of a bunch of neighborhoods that I suppose it was one of the first attempts to gather together all the different individuals who were looking for a sense of belonging. This is in England, of course, London. Caribbeans that were new to the country, the Irish community that gathered around that area in Hammersmith, the Anglo-Saxon Protestant bunch that, you know, had fought in a couple of wars and wanted to get back to work and have a quiet life, the gypsy community who were being urged to move out of their caravans and live normal lives, and all those people, and of course the Asian community who were starting to come to the UK. This is in the 20s and 30s and at the turn of the century. And the White City was one of the first big experiments to bring all those people together. So when we hit the 60s, particularly the very early 60s, it was interesting that to me as a kid, I remember being, you know, in this mod group called the High Numbers, which later became The Who, with a bunch of mod fans. And those groups of fans would be like quite an ethnic mix. You know, there would be Caribbean kids, there would be gypsy kids, there would be Pakistanis or Indians, there would be Irish, and there would be English and Scottish and Welsh and all the rest. It's about as close as we ever got to the kind of eclectic ethnic mix that you have in the USA, you know? Suddenly I felt a need to go back and look at it. And what I actually did is I went back physically. I spent literally 2 weeks walking about this huge estate. It's like a housing project. Meeting people, talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
featuring an all-star band including Pink Floyd's David Gilmour on guitar. That's Pete Townshend with Give Blood from 1985's White City. I'm Redbeard. This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my guest Pete Townshend. For interviews and exclusive live performances by the biggest names in rock, visit inthestudio.net. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Barbarossa Limited Productions. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunette. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Be a part of the In the Studio Network at inthestudio.net.